inch and row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. And inch by inch and row by row, someone blessed these seeds I sowed. Someone warmed them from below till the rains come and tumble them down.
Welcome to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a production of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. We are Teresa Golden and Jean Thomas, Master Gardener volunteers. We discuss gardening issues seasonally and describe the events and educational services we provide. The seasoning segments appear on a timely basis, according to what's happening in our gardens during the year. Outstanding in their field segments are an opportunity to introduce our most outstanding volunteers individually. Cross-pollinating stories will discuss the activities of master gardeners in additional roles. We have master foresters and master naturalists included in our membership, as well as master beekeepers. We even have brewmasters. There are other offerings available from Cooperative Extension, and we will periodically be chatting with representatives of the busy 4-H program and the Taste of New York market, as well as the various offerings for assistance with family life, from child care to budget planning. From time to time, we will go live for a call-in show when a particularly urgent topic arises. The podcast of Digging In with Master Gardeners is available through this station and via a link on our own website at ccecolumbiagreen.org/gardening.
Welcome to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. I'm Teresa Golden, and with me is Jean Thomas. We are two of the Master Gardener volunteers that help to educate county residents on a variety of community horticultural topics. Thank you for joining us today. The topic for this segment is all about birds. Joining us for this discussion is Catherine Schneider, another one of our Master Gardener volunteers and past president of New York State Ornithological Association. Thank you for joining us. Let's start by having you introduce yourself and tell us about how you got interested in birds.
Thank you for having me. I got interested in birds at least partly because my mother was a bird watcher. I was fortunate to grow up in an outdoorsy kind of a family. My dad grew up in the Adirondacks, and my mother, though she was from Brooklyn, learned to love the outdoors as much as my father did. So it wasn't surprising that I had an interest in biology, and when I finished high school, I went to Cornell University, and I studied biology. I got interested in birds there. I took an ornithology class my junior year, and then I went to graduate school at Princeton University, where I studied population biology. I did my thesis on winter flocks of white-throated sparrows, and from there, I started in a career in conservation and college teaching. I taught college at several different colleges, the University of Richmond in Richmond, Virginia, and also at Hudson Valley Community College. And I also worked for a program called the New York Natural Heritage Program, which is a biodiversity inventory program, which at the time I worked for it was jointly run by the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation and the Nature Conservancy. We were basically involved in documenting sites that had important sites for rare species and for very nice natural communities. So I guess that's basically my background.
Okay. I understand that you're a published author. Tell us about your book.
Well, I wanted to write a book that would get people to look at the birds beyond their bird feeders. When I walked around my neighborhood, I noticed that a lot of people have bird feeders. People are genuinely interested in birds, but many of the bird feeders in the neighborhood are empty because people get bored seeing the same birds over and over again. So my book is about going birding, taking your binoculars and identification guide and going someplace to see birds. The first few chapters talks about getting into birding, finding the right kind of binoculars and identification guides, finding birds and learning to key in on what you need to see to identify them. I talk about why it's important to record what you see and how to do it so it makes you a better birder. There's a section about how to find birds. It basically involves learning a little bit about bird biology so you can understand what the birds need. Birds fly, and that means of getting around uses a whole lot of energy. They have a really high metabolic rate, and they need food for everything they do, from singing to defending territories to finding a mate, building a nest, laying an egg, laying eggs, molting, and replacing their feathers once or twice a year. All of that takes energy and requires food. Here in the Northeast, we live in a seasonal environment. There's a lot of food for birds in the summer, but in winter, there's a lot less available. The insects mostly die or become dormant, and many of our insect birds simply migrate as a way of dealing with the food shortage. Other birds eat insects, eggs, or pupae, or increase the amount of vegetable matter in their diet and eat seeds, berries, and the food at your bird feeder. So if you pay attention to what birds eat, you can find a lot more birds. I like to say, find the food, find the bird. The other half of my book is mostly about places to go bird watching in the Hudson Valley, where you can see birds. It's a site guide with directions to the best places to see different kinds of birds for each of the 10 counties in the Hudson Valley. There are great grasslands, different kinds of forests, beautiful Hudson River marshes, accessible mountaintops, really lots of great places to see birds that are bird-friendly and birder-friendly as well.
Okay, for today, let's start with some of the basic bird feeding issues and then discuss how to expand from a bird feeder to becoming a birder in the greater world. Well, people have been feeding and watering wild birds for centuries. It wasn't until, 1968 when they invented the tube bird feeder that the hobby exploded. It's now the second most popular hobby in the country, behind gardening, of course. The bird feeder enabled an easy, convenient, relatively inexpensive hobby. That said, what should I feed the birds?
Well, let's start by being clear about why we are feeding birds. We feed birds mostly for our own enjoyment, to see them and to learn about them, not necessarily to help them out. The birds don't really need your help to find food, but they're happy to take a free lunch, especially when it's cold and their energy demands are really, really high. Then there'll be lots of birds at your feeder. Improper bird feeding can actually hurt birds. So because feeding them improperly can expose them to disease, they sometimes strike windows, they're exposed to cats and other predators. Ideally, we would feed birds something close to what they would eat in nature. So seeds like black oil sunflower seed, which has a lot of energy in it, is a good choice. I like to diversify my offerings by giving them white proso millet on the ground, especially for the sparrows, and suet in the suet feeder for woodpeckers. You can increase the diversity of birds that come to your feeder by offering them different kinds of foods in different kinds of feeding situations. Gray catbirds, for example, are big fruit eaters, and they love to eat raisins.
Are there certain types of plants we should have in our garden to attract birds? I hear that about hummingbirds liking red flowers. Are there specific plants that attract certain birds?
Well, definitely. The rule of thumb is to use native food plants in your yard as much as you can. Native plants are especially beneficial to our birds and insects because they evolve together. With only a few exceptions, nearly all birds feed their young animal matter, like caterpillars, because the babies need protein to grow. But the adults eat other things. They, like hummingbirds, eat nectar. Other birds eat buds, seeds, and fruits. One researcher, a guy named Doug Talamay, has actually shown that native oak trees support more than 500 different kinds of caterpillars that emit from butterflies and moths. But a tree like a ginkgo, which is from Asia, actually only supports 5 kinds of caterpillars. These are the things that are useful to birds. So I try to plant a lot of native plants in my garden. The Audubon Society website has a whole database of native plants where you can search by zip code, so that you can find native plants to plant in your yard that will do well in your area. There are some that are especially well-suited to home gardens and good for the birds because of their seeds and fruit. So trees, for example, any oak or cherry, or also shad trees, things like serviceberry or amelanchier, those are other names for shad tree, dogwoods, red cedar, mountain ash, those all produce good fruits for birds. Among the shrubs, witch hazels, viburnums, winterberry has great berries this year, pussy willows, spice bush, blueberries, raspberries. And with flowers, things like black-eyed Susans, purple coneflower, asters, sunflowers, goldenrods. But you have to be careful. You can't deadhead these things. Don't remove the flowers. Leave the seeds all winter for the birds.
There's nothing prettier than a goldfinch out in the snow eating the tops off the coneflowers.
Yeah, they're beautiful. Also things like mountain mints and wild geraniums, turtlehead. Turtlehead is actually not only good for birds, but it's a food plant for a really beautiful butterfly called the Baltimore. Hummingbirds will use any kind of tubular flower, not just red ones. And they come to even some of the smallest, tiniest little white flowers that are on things like our Solomon seals, for example. Also, there are many of these are important plant and nectar sources for butterflies as well.
Okay, getting back to directly feeding the birds, is there a specific time of year that makes sense to put out a bird feeder and a time to discontinue feeding?
Well, winter is really a good time to put out a feeder because the birds are hungry. The energy demands are high in winter, and they're more likely to come to your feeder than to explore other food sources away from the feeder. It's cold, and their energy demands are high, so they're more likely to come and take advantage of your offerings at this time of year. Besides, it's nice to sit in your jammies with a warm cup of coffee and watch the birds from the warmth of your kitchen table. They are simply easier to attract to a feeder in winter. Second, some people have problems with bears ripping down their feeders. In winter, bears are hibernating. So if you have bears in your area, you should never feed birds in winter you should only feed birds in winter when the birds are hibernating and not feed them in the summer when they will want to eat your bird seed as well. It's generally best to have feeders up only from about in bear areas from about the end of November into early April. Those are the times the bears are generally sleeping. And this is because once a bear discovers a feeder, they will come back over and over and over again. They have a wonderful memory. Try a hummingbird feeder in the summer if you have bears in your area. Bears seem to leave these alone.
What about my very favorite squirrels?
Well, there are a number of things you can do about squirrels. First, you can be smarter than the squirrel. Watch the squirrel and how it approaches the feeder. Generally, the rule of thumb is to place your feeder at least 10 feet from any tree branches that the squirrels can climb from. I also recommend using a baffle of some type. The very best baffles are these stovepipe baffles that go underneath on a pole. Another thing you can do is put a loose disc of plastic above the feeder on a string or a cable. They have to be loose because when the squirrel hits it, you want them to touch it and fall off. But baffles above and below a feeder usually work pretty well. There are also some really great squirrel-proof feeders, the ones that close using with the weight of the squirrel or a very large bird or maybe even a chipmunk.
Those do work. I've had them.
They work great.
Yeah. Okay, what about grackles and cowbirds and starlings? Oh, my.
Yeah, grackles, they come in groups, usually during migration. And large flocks of grackles and cowbirds and starlings can clean out your suet feeder in a day. I suggest if you have problems with grackles and even crows, bring your feeders in for a few days. These birds are migratory. They'll probably leave the area if the food's not available. And then put them back out when they leave the area.
What's the typical issue when you're asked, why are there no birds on my feeder? And what do you do about hawks?
The question about no birds comes up a lot in the fall, but also in the summer. This fall especially, we had a really great fruit crop. It was a wonderful year for acorns, you may have noticed. But there's a lot of natural food around, and when there's plenty of natural food, the living is easy for the birds. They don't need your bird feeder. They don't have to come to it. In summer, the birds are busy feeding their babies, and they're feeding their babies insects or animal matter. They are not feeding them things from your bird feeder for the most part. Those babies need the protein to grow big and strong. When the parents come to your feeder, they usually look like they've been through the war. Their feathers are all worn. They've been feeding the birds all day, and they're just trying to get some food themselves. They're not taking it to their babies under those circumstances. They come only briefly to refuel so they can go out and look for insects and feed the kids again.
I have bluebirds.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have me. And in the spring, they're absolutely crazy looking for protein.
Mm-hmm.
And I feed them. I have a feeder that I put out, live mealworms
for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is that something that's a choice in the spring to encourage?
Yeah, mealworms are great, and lots of birds love them. And sometimes they will feed their babies mealworms. They're a little expensive, but you can buy them freeze-dried.
No, they won't eat those.
Fresh ones are really great. Yeah.
Okay. What about the predators?
It's not unusual for a Sharpshin hawk or a Cooper's hawk to discover that you have birds at your feeder. Feral cats are also sometimes a problem as well. But I feel differently about feral cats. I think they should be indoors and they should be trapped and removed from feeders if they're taking birds from your feeder. But sharp-shinned hawks and Cooper's hawks are natural enemies of birds, and they got to eat too, you know. They may keep birds from using a feeder for a while, but they generally don't stay at one feeder all the time. They diversify their feeding choices and go different places. I think you should let the sharp-shinned hawks and the Cooper's hawks stay and get a junco once in a while because they got to eat too. If you're really worried about this, you can, of course, take in your feeders for a while. That will make the birds go away, and that will also make their predators go away.
Okay, I've got a question about a gangster. These are really not predators, and they're not pretty birds, except after the first time you've seen them. Blue jays.
Mm-hmm.
They make mobs in the fall and just bully everybody else. Mm-hmm. Anything to do about that?
Give them their own food. I have a what we call a blue jay feeder. It basically looks like a wire wreath. And we put peanuts in it. And the blue jays like peanuts more than anything else. So they will eat the peanuts off the peanut feeder and leave the other feeders alone.
This is peanuts in the shell?
Peanuts in the shell. Because then they take them out of this wire mesh cage and they take them away. Sometimes they cache them and store them for a period of time. But even if they just eat them, it takes them a while to open the shells and get the peanuts out, and it keeps them busy.
So does it look like a barroom floor when they're finished?
I find peanuts all over my... I find the shells all over my garden.
Okay. Many of us have discovered that it's not only fun to observe them in the wild, but it's great to ID them. It takes time to get to know the birds in our backyards and to identify them with the skill of an expert. What's the best way to ID the birds I see?
There are a couple of different ways. Many of us learn to identify birds using a field guide. This is just a bird identification guide, and Sibley is one. The Peterson field guide is another. There are lots of different field guides out there, and if you like a book, you just have to figure out which one you like best. But now, in this day and age, there are apps that you can use. If you should look at them carefully with binoculars and try and take a mental snapshot of what the bird looks like, consider things like its size. How big is it? Is it sparrow size, or is it blue jay size, or is it crow size? Look especially at bill shape. Look at how it's sitting, its posture. Does it sit upright like a raptor, or does it bend over like a robin? Note especially the colors, the patches of color, eye stripes, wing bars, that sort of thing, and pay attention to its behavior. I would urge you to write down what you see so that you remember it. So I wanted to talk just a bit about this app called Merlin Bird ID, which has been developed by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. It's a free phone app, and it's meant for bird identification. And it works really, really well because the process of identifying birds is basically process of winnowing down the possibilities. And the thing is that your phone knows things about you. It knows the date and it knows where you are, among other things. So it has those two pieces of data. It knows the time of year and your location. And then it asks you to answer other questions. It asks you how big is the bird, and it gives you choices. Is it Canada goose size down to sparrow size? It asks you for the three main colors, and you fill that in on the app. And then it asks you about behavior. Is it on the ground? Is it on the water? Is it in a bush? And so forth. And when you answer these questions, it gives you pictures of possible choices of birds based on birds that are known to be in your area. So it's not going to ask you, it's not going to give you a choice of a hummingbird in the middle of winter when hummingbirds aren't here. It's not going to give you birds from the West Coast, which are not here. Whereas the book, you have to do that winnowing down process yourself. The app does it for you. So Merlin Bird ID is a wonderful way to start learning to identify birds.
I've used that app and it is extremely helpful.
Yeah.
I agree.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of binoculars should I buy for bird watching? I think they're useful even if the feeder is close to the house for seeing detailed markings and behaviors.
Absolutely right. I think you should use binoculars at your feeder to learn the fine details of birds. For birders, binoculars are really the tools of the trade. But the problem is that they make lots of different kinds of binoculars for lots of different purposes. There are binoculars for sporting events, for viewing opera, for backpacking, for sailing, and they are not all appropriate for bird watching. For birding, what you want is a pair of binoculars that have a magnification somewhere between 7 and 10. There's a number with an X on it on your binoculars, and that gives you the magnification. Those small, compact binoculars that everyone likes to carry around in their purse and their backpack are not particularly good for bird watching, unless you're an experienced birder, because they have a very limited field of view. The higher the magnification, the smaller area you're going to see. And a good large field of view is particularly useful because birds move around and you want to keep them in your vision when you're looking through your binoculars. Another thing that's important is to try and get binoculars that are coated with non-reflective coatings. These non-reflective coatings make the binoculars look a little purple when you look through them, but the non-reflective coatings allow more light to reach your eyes. If you wear glasses, it's good to have binoculars that have eye cups that can be folded down or screwed down. This keeps the distance between your eyes and the lens the same for a person with eyeglasses as a person that doesn't wear eyeglasses. So you have that adjustment that you can make. And I want to say that you don't have to buy top-of-the-line binoculars for birding. I found really good binoculars for bird watching on Craigslist, on eBay, even at yard sales for a song. I mean, you can get them very inexpensively if you're patient and you know what you're looking for.
Very, very helpful. How can I see more birds? And what I mean by that is different kinds of birds than, say, the typical songbirds you see at a feeder.
Well, you have to move beyond your bird feeder. No matter how many different kinds of food you offer and how many different ways you present it, there are just some birds that will never come to a bird feeder. The way to see more birds is to take your binoculars and go places where the birds live. Go for a walk in a forest or a marsh or a grassland and pay attention to the birds that live there. I put some really great bird watching sites in my book, but better yet, don't go by yourself. Go with a local bird club. There are bird clubs in every county in the Hudson Valley, and my book has a list of them. They all have websites on the internet. The Alan DeVoe Bird Club and the Hudson Mohawk Bird Club are local ones that I belong to, and they have field trips, and they welcome people that are not members of their clubs on these field trips. They have these field trips almost every weekend, and new birders are embraced and encouraged to participate. Just show up dressed for the outdoors, bring your binoculars, and the trip leaders will help you find and identify the birds you see.
Okay, we talked about bird feeders. Let's switch gears and talk about bird houses. Many birds have very exacting habitat requirement, I've learned that much, and specifically safe nesting sites. What should we look for when we're selecting a birdhouse?
You should think about what bird you'd like to have nest in your birdhouse. Birdhouses are for hole nesters. There are only certain kinds of birds that nest in holes, and those are the ones that will come to birdhouses. They're basically meant to be a substitute for a natural tree cavity, which may not always be available. Each hole nester has a favorite size hole and cavity size. So if you want to attract eastern bluebirds, for example, you need a nest box that has a hole that's 1.5 inches in diameter. House wrens like a nest box with about 1 inch in diameter hole, and screech owls like a 3-inch hole, and of course a bigger box. The dimensions and hole sizes for hole nesting birds are well documented, and this information is available online just by looking at it. And most of the boxes that you buy in the stores are designed for house wrens or eastern bluebirds.
Now, as I recall, these were a good way to save endangered species. Wasn't that long ago that the Bluebird Society built up in New York State and made bluebirds houses available because there were no longer natural holes available?
The problem is that people cut down dead trees, and dead trees are the ones that have the holes in them. But there was competition with European starlings. European starlings are introduced. They're an exotic species from Europe, and they use the same nest size hole as bluebirds do. And starlings are very aggressive, and they will outcompete the bluebirds.
So they were at risk on several levels.
Right.
Okay. I hear that it's also important to provide a source of water for the birds if you want them to hang around in the yard. What specific things should I look for when I want a bird bath? I don't just go get that concrete upside-down mushroom thing.
I don't think you should do that, no. You want a bird bath that isn't too deep, for starters. a nice gradual incline. Think a flying saucer sled in terms of steepness is what the birds really want. If it's too deep, all the birds will do is sit around the edge of it and drink water. I like to put flat rocks in my bird bath so they have more places to be on the edge of the water. It's especially nice to provide liquid water in winter when most of the water is frozen because the birds need water to drink and bathe. Ceramic bird baths aren't particularly good in winter because they freeze and crack. They actually absorb some of the water, and therefore they'll crack a lot in winter if there's water in them. So I personally prefer plastic or metal ones. And if your bird bath is new, you might want to try putting it on the ground. The birds are going to be more attracted to a bird bath that's near cover. So if you find a place that's near cover and on the ground for starters, then once they find it, you can move it up and make it more visible for you to watch. And also, remember to clean your bird bath out once in a while. It's not that the birds mind so much, but it just becomes mosquito breeding habitat, and we don't like mosquitoes much.
When you look for a bird bath, especially online, you find these mildew drops. Are they helpful or not necessary, or...?
Just changing the water regularly is just as good. I don't think mildew drops make a big difference. You do want the water to stay clean. The birds get feces in them and things like leaves drop in them. So I think it's just better to change the water regularly.
You are listening to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, with offices in Hudson in Columbia County and Acre in Greene County. You can learn more about the Cooperative Extension by visiting the website at ccecolumbiagreene.org or on Facebook. If you have a gardening question or would like to suggest a topic for a future radio show, you can also email us at colgremg@cornell.edu. All About Birds is today's topic, and we are joined by Catherine Schneider. Let's dig in deeper. Now that we've covered some of the basic home landscape bird feeding and observation, let's expand our universe. Your book, Birding the Hudson Valley, is a treasure trove of places beginners can go to start learning about more birds that don't show up at the feeders. And the beauty about these places is that they're local. Could you tell us about some of the places in the Twin Counties people can explore? Most of them are free, too. Isn't that right?
Yes, I tried to put in places that were mostly free. A few of them are state parks, and state parks usually charge during the summer, but other times they're available pretty much for free. My book has information on 16 great places to see birds in Columbia and Greene counties. In Columbia County, I really love Ooms Conservation Area at Sutherland Farm, and the reason for this is that this property is owned by the Columbia Land Conservancy, and it's managed specifically for grassland birds. Grassland birds are birds that require grassland habitat in order to breed and reproduce. And since the Hudson Valley is naturally forested, our grasslands are artificial. They're basically created by humans for hay fields and pastures. The birds use them to breed, but all too often, once they start breeding and their nests, which are on the ground, are starting to become productive, the nests get mowed because the farmer has come to hay the field. Or sometimes they're trampled by cows in pastures. So it's great that Columbia Land Conservancy has set aside this land specifically for grassland birds. It's mowed after the breeding season is finished, and so the birds are able to complete their nesting cycle. It has a lovely pond, and it's just teeming with bobolinks, eastern meadowlarks, savannah sparrows, and other grassland bird species. In Greene County, I really like the Mountain Tarp Arboretum. As the name implies, this is a botanical garden, and it's basically designed for plants that can live at 2,400 feet because this site is at elevation. But because it has some elevation, it also has a mixture of habitats that's meant to support different plants, but of course also supports different birds. So there are uncommon birds there, like yellow-bellied sapsuckers, purple finch, which usually is at elevation, winter wren, hermit thrush. These are birds that you don't see at lower elevations in the Hudson Valley. The woods are good for wood warblers in the spring, too.
And there's one habitat that I don't see listed. I'm in Greene County, and the Ramshorn facility is pretty awesome for the water birds and for river.
That's in my book.
Yeah, that's a really nice one. And there's a whole other population there of bird varieties as well.
Oh, Virginia rails. It's a place you can be sure and see Virginia rails, among, and lots of good flycatchers there. It's on the river, so we see eagles regularly. There's a great horn nest owl that nests in the woods on the edge of that property. So that's a really wonderful site, too.
And you can get in there and access it with kayaks, correct? So you can go in among the swamp type.
Yep, you can get into it different ways.
All right, now I understand that you frequently lead bird watches yourself, not only as a Master Gardener volunteer, but for local bird clubs and other organizations. Where can folks find out about upcoming walks?
When I lead bird walks, I usually do them for either the Allen DeVoe Bird Club or the Hudson Mohawk Bird Club. These clubs both have websites. It's Allen DeVoe's website is allendevoebirdclub.org. And Hudson Mohawk's site is hmbc.net. Both of these websites have lists of field trips, and you'll be able to see what trip is offered each weekend, where people are going, where the meetup place is, and who the trip leader is. These clubs also put things in local newspapers, and Allen DeVoe Bird Club has been setting up a lot of field trips with partner organizations like the Shaker Museum at Mount Lebanon and Columbia Land Conservancy, as well as their own.
Now let's go to the dark side. That's my favorite place. I see that you've studied population biology, and that reminds me of the newest climate catastrophe. Bird populations have plummeted across the board in North America. What does that really mean? Is this the future Rachel Carson foresaw, but for other reasons than she observed? Is there anything we can do?
Yes, that recent study was very disturbing. It was done by a group of 7 scientists, and it was published in the journal Science, which is one of the most respected peer-reviewed journals in biology, and it's very disturbing. The study looked at 529 bird species in the continental United States and Canada, and it used data from different sources, specifically different bird monitoring programs like the Breeding Bird Survey and the Christmas Bird Count. And it looked at it over the last 50 years, and it compared those trends to trends that they were able to deduce from looking at radar. Radar studies can be used to show the number of birds that are migrating. So these declines showed up both in the 50 years of monitoring data and in 50 years of radar data. What was really disturbing was that the declines were among all groups of birds, eastern forest birds, boreal birds, shore birds, grassland birds, all showed big losses. The only groups that were doing well are waterfowl, raptors, and game birds. Those showed increases, which probably tells us if we've learned how to manage those birds that are hunted. Unfortunately, it seems we haven't really learned to manage the birds that are not hunted as well. So the question then becomes, what can we do? Should we just give up and settle for fewer birds in this world? I'm not really willing to do that. There is no single cause for declines of this magnitude in so many groups of birds, but there are some steps you can take to help birds. This study recommended, in fact, that one of the things we should do is help birds do things like avoid window strikes. Many birds are killed around feeders, but even not around feeders because they strike windows. With your feeder, if you put your feeder 3 feet from a window or 30 feet from a window, and this will help them avoid strikes because if they're close, they're not going fast enough to get hurt. 30 feet, they're not likely to hit a window. And you can also put, if you have a problem with window strikes at your feeders, you can put reflective tape on them or netting across it to help birds avoid window strikes. One of the things, I mean, I like cats, but keeping cats indoors is essential. Cats kill tens of, maybe hundreds of thousands of birds every year, and they're responsible for the extinction of some species on islands. Cats do not need to be outdoors. They may like to look outdoors, but they don't need to be outdoors, and by keeping cats indoors, you are helping the birds. Planting native plants. Native plants are much more valuable to birds than non-native plants. So we've already covered this a bit, but planting native plants is a good idea. Avoid the use of pesticides. Avoid plastics. Plastics in the ocean kill thousands of seabirds every year. They also recommend that we drink shade-grown coffee because coffee farms actually are destroying tropical forests, which, of course, is where the birds spend the winter if they're migratory. And you can help by monitoring bird populations. We would not even know of these declines if people hadn't been doing citizen science project, participating in Christmas bird counts, doing birding bird surveys, and participating in state bird atlases. New York is about to kick off its third breeding bird atlas, which documents the distribution of breeding birds in New York State. You can participate in this as well.
So for the Christmas count, that I always hear about, like, the day before or the day of. Are there links that people can go on Facebook?
You can
find out?
Google Christmas bird count. It's run by the Audubon Society, and you can find a count near you very easily by just putting in your zip code.
Okay, because that's a great thing to do with kids.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now I have my favorite little hit list. We talked about this earlier. And I'm observing things, and I always have peculiar explanations for them in my own head. So let's talk about specific birds. When you see robins in the middle of the winter, you say, oh my gosh, the robins are back. It must be spring. What's the deal with that?
Robins are here all winter. They're just not on your lawn. Your lawn is frozen, and they can't get anything from your lawn when it's frozen. They move into the woods to eat fruit. The robins that are here in winter may not be the same robins that are here in the spring. Robins do a partial migration, so some of the birds migrate and others don't, and some of the birds that are here are from northern places that they move out of, like that are too cold, farther north. So we get a mix of residents and then also ones that have moved in from other areas. But robins are here all winter, and they're in the woods eating fruit like sumac and poison ivy and any other kinds of berries they can find.
Which is why you see them in flocks in the winter, not in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
Now then, bluebirds do the same thing with that step migration kind of thing?
I think less so. I think most of the bluebirds we have here are resident because they're more tied to the nest boxes. You see a lot of family groups, often in the vicinity of nest boxes from the previous year, but they are looking for fruit, so they range more widely than they do during the breeding season.
Okay. Now, ravens. We've all watched, Fire and Ice movie with the raven, the three-eyed raven and everything. And I had always heard that ravens were very shy and that they were scarce. And I see a lot around and I'm noisy and they're not shy. What's the story there?
Ravens have been increasing in abundance. And, of course, a lot of people don't know the difference between ravens and crows. And there is a difference. Ravens are bigger. They have a slightly different shaped tail. And they behave very differently from crows. But ravens are becoming more common in New York State specifically, mostly moving into more suburban habitats than they have in the past.
They had been isolated, right?
They tend to nest near quarries and cliffs and things like that, and they seem to be taking advantage of other kinds of habitats for nesting.
Oh, okay, that's different. All right, and then the biggie, in more ways than one. It's been the last couple of decades I've seen vultures, and they've been new to somebody that grew up without any around. And now they used to migrate, but now I see them all over the place all year round. Is there a backstory to that?
The common vulture that we see in the summer is the turkey vulture. And turkey vultures are migratory. We typically have them here in the summer, and then they migrate in huge numbers to spend the winter farther south. But there is another vulture called the black vulture, which has moved into our area recently from the south. It's expanding its range north from the south. And black vultures look somewhat similar to turkey vultures, but they have a shorter tail. And therefore, when they fly, their feet hang out beyond their tail, which is a good way to identify them. And black vultures, unlike turkey vultures, are non-migratory. They stay here year-round. And in winter, now we have black vultures that we never had before. And black vultures also tend to be in roosts a lot of the time in winter. They take advantage of the heat coming out of chimneys a lot of the time. So they will sit on chimneys. They will eat dog food. Yeah, that you see them in numbers in very often. It's very interesting. We're going to have to learn to live with these black vultures. They are fairly brazen, and they will come to bird feeders and things like that if you have the right kind of food there for them. So you keep an eye out for black vultures because they're becoming more and more common.
Kathy, it's been a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and expertise. We'd also like to thank WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for hosting this program, as well as the production support from Donna Peterson and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this edition of Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. You can learn more about Cornell Cooperative Extension by checking out our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. If there are topics or questions you'd like us to answer on future episodes of this show, email us at colgremg@cornell.edu and include radio show in the subject title. You can contact us with any other gardening questions also by emailing us at colgremg@cornell.edu. Master Gardeners are typically available on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday in the Hudson office or on Tuesday and Thursday mornings in the Aqua office. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, inch by inch, row by row, let us help your garden grow.
Inch by inch and row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. And inch by inch and row by row, someone bless these seeds I sow. Someone warm them from below till the rains come tumbling down.
Welcome to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. This program is broadcast by courtesy of WGXC Radio 90.7 FM. I'm Jean Thomas, and with me is fellow Master Gardener Devin Russ. We are two of the Master Gardener volunteers who help to educate Twin County residents on a variety of community horticultural topics. Thank you for joining us today. The topic for this segment is pollinators. And with us is Tim Kennelty, a fellow Master Gardener. Tim is also a Master Naturalist and serves on the Board of Trustees of the Columbia Land Conservancy. Tim has gardened in Columbia County for over 25 years and has developed a passion for preserving native species and combating exotic invasive plants. Currently, he's involved in a multi-year habitat restoration project in Ghent, New York. Welcome, Tim. That's quite a resume.
Thank you, Jean. It's great to be here.
Okay, so I can assume that your expertise in pollinators is a natural progression. If you're interested in preserving native plant species, you need to know their requirements to thrive, as well as the needs of the insects and animals that are their partners in the survival dance.
Yeah, that's really true. I mean, if the two things go hand in hand, if you're really interested in planting natives and making sure that you eliminate or reducing invasive species, what you're really doing is preserving ecosystems and preserving areas and habitat that really will support pollinators and birds and really, you know, kind of all the fauna out there.
Now, I have a note here about attracting native pollinators from the Xerxes Society. Could you tell us a little more about that?
Well, the Xerxes Society is a group, a really good group that they produce books and I think videos as well. And their mission is to preserve pollinators through education, and they get grants. But there's some very, very good literature and books, and I think you can be, I'm a member. Their website has a lot of information as well. So they really focus on pollinators.
Okay, let's start with some definitions. What do we mean when we talk about pollinators? You and I talk about them all the time, and we know what we mean, but the listener doesn't necessarily.
We do talk about them all the time. You know, there are bat and bird pollinators, but the vast majority of pollinators in North America are insects. And really all we are talking about is an insect that goes to a flower to consume pollen or to consume nectar, or some of them go to mate at a flower. And what happens is they get pollen grains stuck on their legs usually, and some are kind of more equipped to do this than others. And when they go from flower to flower, they basically leave those pollen grains, and it basically fertilizes the flower, and the flower then produces seeds. There's really four types of insect pollinators. There are bees and wasps, butterflies and moths, some types of flies are pollinators, and then there are also beetles that are pollinators.
Let's review the elephant in the room. Why do we care about bugs, insects?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's lots of different reasons. First of all, insects are really kind of a harbinger of like how good the environment is, but insects are essentially kind of the bottom of the food chain. So everybody eats insects. Birds eat insects. In fact, songbirds feed their young pretty much exclusively insects. And so if insects are on the decline, which they are, it's an indication that the whole food chain is on the decline. So they're really, really important. And of course, the plants that you have in your garden, the plants that are out there in the woods, et cetera, that are native, support those insects.
Okay, so climate change is going to mess a bunch of that up, right?
Well, habitat loss and climate change, really. Okay. So there's habitat loss, there's habitat fragmentation. When, you know, two parcels of land are, there's development in the middle of it, so you have less and less animals going from one place to another. There's habitat degradation. That usually happens from invasives. All of that is really detrimental to pollinators. But then climate change is kind of an additional factor. And what's happening with climate change, one of the major things is that plants geographically are blooming at different times. So they're starting to be out of sync with the insects that are pollinating them. So a lot of kind of negative things happening out there. And as I said, there's a decline in insect populations. About 40% of our insect populations are on steep decline. So it's pretty severe things going on out there as far as pollinators.
Okay, so we've reviewed some of the big picture issues. Let's start with some particular insect pollinators. As you said, there are beetles and even flies that are good pollinators. And I just read that mosquitoes and ants do their part too. What about bees? I know my garden's happiest when it's humming.
Yeah, bees are pretty much the most important pollinators out there because, I mean, they're really good at it because most bees have hairs along their legs that almost act as Velcro that pick up the pollen grains. And so when they go from flower to flower, they're very effective pollinators.
And of course, the honeybees are manipulable. You can just move them around in big boxes and put them to work in commercial
I like the word manipulable, yeah. Well, yeah, honeybees have been used in commercial agriculture for a long time, and it's because you're absolutely right. They're basically transportable, but also they're in colonies. Most bees aren't in colonies, so there are large, large numbers of female bees, honeybees, that do the pollination. So they've been a very, very effective means of pollinating agricultural crops. They're from Europe. They're not native, but they have been used very effectively in commercial agriculture.
Okay, if honeybees aren't native, what bees are? And how many kinds are there in our area?
Yeah, there's lots and lots of native bees. In North America, there's almost 4,000 different species of native bees. Around us, we probably have several hundred different types of native bees. And I think that kind of misconception that most people have is they think of bees that are very communal and they're in a hive and, you know, they're swarming. There's, you know, lots of bees in a particular area. But the fact of the matter is 90% of native bees are what we would call solitary. So a single male and a single female. And they're not generally all in one big hive. Generally, what happens is about 70% of them are nesting in the ground and about 30%, the other 30% or so, nest in the stems of plants. So not really what most people think in terms of native bees.
Are they all pollinators?
Yeah, most bees are pollinators, and I think there may be some exceptions. I think the difference that you see among bees is, again, the thing that's just so awesome about nature is that bees have co-evolved with flowers. So there are some bees that have, you know, very particular mouth parts, and some are very effective at pollinating like very deep flowers, like tubular flowers. And then some are generalists. They'll go to just about any flower. They're not very picky. So it really depends on the bee in terms of what flower it will go to, but most of them are pollinators.
Okay, my 10-year-old self wants to know, aren't they dangerous? Don't they all have stingers?
Oh, Jean, come on. You're afraid of everything. No, many of my gardening friends and non-gardening friends are afraid of bees. In fact, I had a friend who asked me about what some flower species that she wanted to put in her garden, but she said, just no bees. Well, that's kind of hard to do. Most bees, for the wide, wide majority of bees, are not a danger to you at all. In fact, for most bees, the only time they're really in danger of stinging you is if they're protecting their nest. So if they're out foraging, if they're out consuming nectar, that's really what they're focusing on, and they won't sting you. The only time they're really going to sting you is when you're in their area of their nest or something like that. And most bee stingers won't even penetrate human flesh. Most of the species won't penetrate human flesh. Of course, if you get stung, honeybees are the only bees that the stinger will stick in you. You want to pull that out if you get stung. Most people have a very mild reaction. If you do have any kind of shortness of breath or nausea or vomiting or dizziness, you want to seek medical attention. But for the most part, it's a misconception that bees are out there to get you. You know, they're not really very dangerous unless you're threatening their nest. And again, the ones that are probably in most in danger of are wasps and hornets and yellow jackets, because they are communal and they do have, you know, you'll see those paper nests. And so if you're batting that paper nest on the eve of your house, you're probably asking for it.
And you also shouldn't dry your laundry outdoors, or if you do, you should shake it out very thoroughly when you bring it back inside. I've got starry salt.
It's like hints from Heloise with you.
Just hints from hell. Wasps and bees are close relatives.
They are, yes.
Okay, and hornets and paper wasps. That's pretty much it. The nests they make are out of paper, and the bees are made out of wax.
Wasps and bees are closely related. That is true. The difference between, one of the big differences between wasps and bees is wasps are, in some stages of their life, meat eaters. At the larva stage, once the egg has hatched and they're in the larva stage, the female bees will have to bring their larva children protein. So they're bringing little pieces of meat from animal carcasses, or maybe they're in your picnic and they're stealing a little bit of meat from your hot dog, but they actually need that meat to survive. And then when those larvae turn into adult bees, hornets, when they turn into adult hornets or wasps or yellow jackets, they're only consuming sugar. So they would be at, you know, flowers for nectar, or they would be, a lot of times you'll see yellow jackets or hornets or wasps under a fruit tree when there's kind of rotting fruit. I've seen many, many yellow jackets under my plum tree when the fruit is rotting, or maybe even at your picnic on a soda can or something like that. The other difference that you might see physically between wasps and bees is that wasps have kind of stouter bodies. A lot of them have that distinctive kind of yellow and black striping. So, you know, there's a little bit of difference in size, but they are very closely related. Many wasps are more communal too. They'll have nests. So there's, you know, multiple females and multiple males in their nests. And again, we talked about they have those kind of papery nests that you'll see under these houses or kind of hanging from trees. But those are the basic differences.
Thank you, Tim. We're so grateful you were able to join us today.
Great to be here.
We'd also like to thank WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for hosting this program and for the production support that was provided by Donna Peterson and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this edition of Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. You can learn more about Cornell Cooperative Extension by checking out our website at ccecolumbiagreene.org. If there are topics or questions you'd like us to answer on future episodes of this show, email us at colgremg@cornell.edu and include radio show in the subject title. You can contact us with any other questions also by emailing us at colgremg@cornell.edu. Master Gardeners are typically available on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday in the Hudson office, or on Tuesday and Thursday mornings in the Acre office. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, inch by inch, row by row, let us help your garden grow.
You can contact Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties with questions at ccecolumbiagreene.org, visit us in Hudson or in Acre, or ask us questions on the Master Gardeners of CCE Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook group. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal program and employment opportunities. Someone warm.
them from below till the rains come.